Okay, so we were discussing Jewish reactions to Copernicus, and last week we discussed the reactions from right after Copernicus till about the 19th century. In the Orthodox world, they were pretty much rejecting it. They were insisting that the Earth is at the center and everything goes around the Earth. And they were claiming that Copernicus was proposing the heliocentric system, which is that the Sun is at the center and everything goes around the Sun. They were rejecting that as being scientifically wrong, theologically wrong, even heretical. Over in the world of the Maskilim, so the Maskilim were pretty much all accepting heliocentrism, and they were claiming that this was really the authentic Jewish view from millennia ago that had just been forgotten in the interim, trying to show that even that Chazal or even Tanakh itself supported the heliocentric model. All right, so those were basically the two options seen now. Well, we thought there were one or two in the Orthodox world who accepted Copernicus. They didn't really go into their reasons. But basically, the two models we've seen are the idea in the Orthodox world that heliocentrism goes completely against tradition and therefore it's wrong, or the idea from the Maskilim that heliocentrism is right and it doesn't go against traditional Jewish views of things. Now let's move on to the 19th century and into the non-Maskilic world. So I'm not going to go through all of the authorities who discuss this topic, because there's really quite a lot of them. I'll just discuss the interesting ones. So, let's begin with Hirsch. Okay, Rav Shimson Raphael Hirsch. Now, he started a new trend in this whole approach to Copernicus. Let me cut and paste what he wrote into the window here. Yeah. So, Rav Hirsch writes as follows. Jewish scholarship has never regarded the Bible as a textbook for physical or even abstract doctrines. In its view, the main emphasis of the Bible is always on the ethical and social structure and development of life on Earth. That is, on the observance of laws through which the momentous events of our nation's history are converted from abstract truths into concrete convictions. That is why Jewish scholarship regards the Bible as speaking consistently in human language. The Bible does not describe things in terms of objective truths known only to God, but in terms of human understanding, which is, after all, the basis for human language and expression. It would have been inconceivable that the Bible should have intended, for example, Joshua's command, O sun, stand still, as implying a biblical dogma confirming or denying the existence of a solar system. The Bible uses human language when it speaks of the rising and setting of the sun, and not of the rotation of the earth, just as Copernicus, Kepler, and other such scientists, in their words and writings, spoke of the rising and setting of the sun, without thereby contradicting truths they had derived from their own scientific conclusions. Now, so he's saying the idea that when the Torah speaks about, seems to be describing a geocentric universe, it's an example of the Torah speaking in the language of man. Now, there's two ways of interpreting what he's saying here. I'm going to start off with a more conservative interpretation, and we'll leave the more radical interpretation for Rav Kook later. The conservative interpretation is he's saying that the Torah uses the language of people in the sense that just as you or I would speak of sunrise, we don't thereby mean that the sun, it's the sun that's moving and the earth that's still. That's the Torah is doing the same thing. It's speaking about the way that people speak about it, but not that the Torah itself means to describe the universe as being geocentric. Now you might think that's, yeah, well, obviously he's saying that. What else could he be saying? Because I'm not exactly sure if that is what he's saying. But that's how I'm going to present it for now. And later when we see with Cook's view, which is quite different, maybe we'll come back to a version and see if that really for sure that this is what he's saying. Okay. Now we'll move on to Malbim. Now Malbim is an interesting person. He was a very interesting mix of progressive and traditionalist. On the one hand, he was quite progressive. He says, for example, that the Rishonim are all wrong in their understanding of certain things in astronomy. On the other hand, when it comes to this particular aspect of astronomy, there's actually some seemingly conflicting statements about whether he went with the geocentric or the heliocentric model, but I think the most conclusive thing is the way he explains the miracle of the sun stopping for Yahushua. He says that the miracle of the sun stopping, he says it demonstrated God's great power in that only the sun and the moon stopped, but everything else kept on moving. Now, that doesn't work with the heliocentric model. Right? Because if the heliocentric model, when the sun and the moon stops, that means that the Earth has stopped. Right? So if the Earth stops, everything stops. Everything is breathing. But if it's the geocentric model, then that makes sense. You talk about just the sun and the moon stop, but everything else continuing as normal. So I think that he's going with the. I think that means that Malvin is going with the geocentric model. Sadika Cohen, right? Sadika of Lublin. He's very skeptical of astronomy, like Maharal. He says that no matter how strong the evidence non-Jewish scientists may appear, we're going to ignore it if it contradicts Chazal. He says that you can't trust science. Science is always changing. They used to think the Earth was the center. Now they think the sun was the center. How can you trust them? And Sadik says that, look, Chazal had a completely different understanding of the universe from modern astronomy. Chazal had the idea of, he says, you spoke about there being windows in the firmament. And he says, Chazal must have been correct, because he says, who ascended to the heavens like they did, figuratively speaking? Sadik says that Chazal were in touch with the roots of everything, the metaphysical, spiritual roots of everything, so how could the scientists possibly know more than Chazal? Let's move on now to let's move on to an interesting figure of Arya Leib Feinstein of Brest-Litovsk, 19th century. Not very well known, but he wrote an interesting book called Elif Magain. And he has something very interesting in there. Let's cut and paste this paragraph onto the screen. Again, this is, to give you the name here, this is Arya Leib Feinstein. Also read a book called, Ir Tehila, like a history book about the city he lived in. So he writes about there being, different kinds of disputes. He says the following thing. Let's go start with the second line here. Notwithstanding that most of the knowledge of the world and of nature has already been discovered by scientists with clear demonstrations and reliable experiments, there are still many things that have not been reliably determined. With regard not merely to specific details, but to general approaches and broad theories as well, the opinions of scholars still diverge, with different scholars adopting differing approaches. Therefore, it is not surprising if in the Talmud too there are disputes in the matter of nature, even regarding matters that have now been clarified through new experiments. This is especially true in matters related to astronomy, which, it is known, was not well understood in the times of Chazal, because before later generations investigated and established it using telescopes. Early Gentile scholars, as well as Chazal in their day, believed the Earth to be flat, contradiction to what has now become clear through compelling demonstrations and the testimony of those who have circumnavigated the Earth, that the Earth is spherical. They also accepted the Ptolemaic view of the sun's motion against the Copernican model, which has now been proven with compelling demonstrations. Therefore, we find that both the sages of Israel and the Gentile sages were of two minds regarding whether the sun revolves above or below the earth, and regarding the orbit of the constellations. One time the Gentile sages agreed with the Jewish sages, and one time the opposite. So he's saying, so he's accepting the Copernican model, but like I say, he's a little known figure. I'm sure nobody here had heard of him. He was also constantly persecuted as being a heretic, including by Rabbi Shulay Diskin. Anything, you know, this shows that accepting the Copernican model was not typical. Right, so you have then a few more other figures in the 19th century, some of whom accept it, some of whom reject it. There's one very vociferous work called a Nevreshet, which he really rails against Copernicus at great length. And I'd like to list all of his claims. We'll go through them and we'll take a look at which ones you think are valid and which aren't. We'll start with this quote here. In here, this is Ruchia David Spitzer of Pressburg. He's cutting and pasting here from my notes. Ruchia David and Yosef Spitzer of Pressburg published a work in astronomy called Nevreshet. It says, woe to the eyes that have seen such an inverted world, the maidservant that inherits her maker and then the slave who rules. Surely it is the earth for whose sake and for the sake of whose inhabitants, Israel, fulfillers of the Holy Torah, everything was created, including the sun, to serve it. And the sun should be serving the earth. The idea of the earth going around the sun, that would be, you know, the slave ruling over the master. It's overturning what the hierarchy should be. Right, so that's a claim that we saw in the Chassam Sofer. Then he brings another interesting objections to heliocentrism. He says, first of all, that it says in Parashas that the earth was made before the sun. So what was it going around? If the earth goes around the sun, it doesn't make any sense that the earth is created first. You know, what's it going around? It's going around nothing. And then he says, listen to this. He says, what goes on at Mamad HaSinai? He says that at HaSinai, earth was in touch with heavens. Now, if earth is moving, what, the heavenly host has to constantly run to keep up with it? And he says that, and if the heavenly host is not constantly running to keep up with the earth, then it would mean that the earth stood still for 40 days while Moshe was up there. And, you know, why wouldn't there be any mention of that miracle? And he says, furthermore, the Beis HaMikdash shall matter is opposite Beis HaMikdash shall mala, right? The earthly temple is opposite the heavenly temple. So does it mean that the heavenly temple is constantly moving around? So, you know, these are very unusual objections to heliocentrism, not the kind we've seen until now. And then another one, and then he objects to other aspects of astronomy, modern astronomy too. He says that these astronomers say that light takes time to travel, and that he says this doesn't make sense because according to the Copernicus, the light of some of the stars has taken tens of thousands of years to get here, but the world is less than 6,000 years old. And then he says that, and they say that the light from the sun takes 8 minutes to get here. He said the light from the sun takes eight minutes to get here. He says, and that means that all the halachic times, such as, you know, nights and so on, which are following the sun, would be off. It means that everyone's always been doing everything at the wrong time. Right, so, you know, these claims sound a bit weird. Uvin Meir says, sounds bizarre, maybe there's a reason no one's ever heard of him. It's not unheard of, actually, this work. It's not so unheard of. So some of these claims sound a little bit real, but actually, a little bit weird, sorry. But I'm going to come back to one of them later, because I think some of them actually have a lot of merit. So we'll get back to them later. Okay. Move on to... let's move on to second. Shmuel ben Yosef Yeshua. He was the grandson of the chief rabbi of the Jewish community of Aden. Aden was a place in Yemen. He wrote an interesting book called Nachlas Yosef, which is a collection of Jewish and scientific knowledge, written in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And in his Sefer, he goes on against how belief in demons and ghosts is just superstitions that have been outdated and people aren't believing in those things anymore. And he says, however, heliocentrism, he says, is completely wrong. And what he says about it, apart from it going against all sense, he says it goes against Chazal and so on, it goes against Pesukim, the familiar claims. And he says that it puts the earth as being one of the host on high, one of the Tzvar Shal Marim. And that's a claim we haven't said much before. We mentioned that Sefer Hebris says that in Tanakh there's a difference between Shemaim and the Aretz. Shemaim, Shemaim Lashem, Aretz Nesan Levnei Adam. That the earth is man's domain, the heavens, which is up there, is a celestial domain. And Copernicus comes and puts the earth in space. Like if you look at this diagram here, so here you have the earth center, that's the material realm, and everything else is a Shemaim. But with the heliocentric model, the earth is in the Shemaim. Right? You're elevating the earth to being one of the heavenly hosts. Let's discuss that, because that was also quite similar to him and David Spitzer's claim, and also the Sefer Bruce's claim. Right? Now, the claim is that... If we talk about the objections to Copernicus, and they fall into several categories. You've got the idea that it goes against Chazal. Okay. You know, Chazal were wrong on several things. They were wrong about where the sun goes at night. Right? We saw a few weeks ago that all of the Shonim accepted that. So the fact that it goes against Chazal isn't such a big deal. Then what about the Pesukim from the Torah? So you have Pesukim that speak about sunrise and things like that. Well, okay, you know, Copernicus also spoke about sunrise. I speak about sunrise. Not anything either. It's all, you know, a part of human speech. But I think the more fundamental objections are the ones that Shmuel ben Yosef, Spitzer, and Sefer Bruce mentioned, which is that in Tanakh, the picture presented is that Shemaim, Shemaim LaHashem, Aretz Nesan Levnei Adam, that there is a difference between Shemaim and Aretz. And what is Shemaim? So, you know, we grew up thinking that Shemaim is some kind of, you know, spiritual realm. But if you look in Tanakh, that's just not how it looks. If you look in Tanakh, you get a clear picture that Shemayim is up there. So look, let's look at these Pesukim. I'm falling off a few weeks ago, but let's look at them again. Alright, so let's start with this. Okay, God looks out on mankind from the heavens to see if there's an intelligent mind seeking his God. Okay, so you can say, you know, symbolically, conceptually, he's looking on mankind from the heavens. But then, what do you do with this? Tehillim Aleph, I raise my eyes to you who dwells in the heavens. You're looking up to God. So Reuven Meir is saying, if you look at Shemayim and Bereshit, it's definitely used for different definitions. Oh yeah? How so? The sources here, we can bring them up on the screen. Right, well, if you're looking up at God, because he's up there in the heavens. Reuven Meir says, it says the birds are in Shemayim and the stars are in Shemayim. No, it doesn't. Let's look at what it says in Bereshit. I'm not going to be able to cut and paste my Hebrew thing into the Pergum, so let's get up on, someone else do it. Can someone post it into the chat box? I'm working on this. Get the Pesukim from Bereshit in English up on your computer and cut and paste them into the chat box. If you want to volunteer, just write down in the chat box that you're volunteering to do that. Oh, Adam's doing it, fine. I can look at it for myself in the meanwhile. It says that the birds are on the face of the heavens. See? Yeah. Right, the birds are over the face of the heavens. See them? Oh, that's right, Adam, I've got it. Right. Yomelekim yishutsu am hamayim sheretz nefesh chayva of v'opi ovif halaoretz al pnei ukiyah hashamayim. The birds are over the face of the heavens. Right? You look at the sky, you see the dome above you, and you see the birds over the face of it. Okay? Mordechai, Hashemayim Mestapim Kavod Kael. That means he's not there. Okay, well, first of all, I mean, there are different layers to the Shemayim. You know, the Gemara in Chagiga speaks about there being seven firmaments. Right, seven layers of the firmament. So, Gemara in Chagiga, above Hesayin, somewhere around there, speaks about there being seven firmaments, and above the highest is the Chayas HaKodesh, and above that is the Kisei HaKavod. The idea that, you know, you can maybe interpret the Gemara in different ways, but certainly when it's speaking about the seven firmaments, those are talking about, you know, domes above the earth, spheres around the earth, but the seven firmaments, those are physical constructs, and it says that Hashem is above them. So there's other Pesukim too. One second. Up another pasuk here. Yeah, God is in his holy temple, God's throne is in the heavens. Right? Let me pull up some more here. Second, it's pulling up Matanach. Second. Here, God sets the stars. Where does he put them? He puts them Berikiyah Hashemayim. Right? So, in Tanakh, you always have mention that there are heavens. Okay, what is the Shemayim? Shemayim is up there. Okay? So, birds are up there, and even higher up there is the sun and the moon. Right? I mean, look, you have... Okay, so Umay is saying the birds are of the heavens. Right? It also has the sun and the stars being of the heavens. So, the point is this, you have one word Shemayim, right? And it's clearly used in some places in Tanakh to mean the place where God is, right? God dwells in the heavens, God's throne is in the heavens, that's what you have these explicit passages in Tehillim. And Shemayim is also clearly used to mean the sky. So you could say, well, it means two different things. Sometimes it means the physical up there, and sometimes it means the spiritual realm. But you know, firstly, you know, that's already quite awkward. Why should the same word mean two different things? But second of all, the problem is that you have this pasuk, which makes both the same thing. I raise my eyes to you who's in the heavens. Why are you looking? You're looking up to God in the heavens. That implies that those two meanings of Shemayim are both the same thing. So, Now, this was... I think that is what is going on in Tanakh. So what are you going to do now? So this is what the cook deals with. I think that all these authorities who are saying that, you know, in Tanakh you see the idea that God is in the heavens, and the heavens is a spiritual realm, and Copernicus is going and he's completely blurring that difference, that there's not the spiritual realm and the earthly realm, but it's just space and the earth is in space. Yes, they're right. Copernicus did very much undermine that. So what are we going to do with the Tanakh? So this is where Rav Kook comes in. This is what Rav Kook addresses. Let me paste the material from Rav Kook here. Hold on. Yeah. So he starts off with fairly mildly, saying as follows. Every intelligent person knows that it's relevant to maintaining faith with regard to the state of scientific or geological knowledge. There's no difference with regard to the words of the Torah, and there's no difference, for example, between Ptolemaic theory and Copernicus, Galileo, and others. Okay, so far nothing special, it's just Dibrata, Galashim, Bnei Adam, just using figures of speech that we use. But then he goes further, because later he speaks about what he discusses, why did the Torah not reveal certain information, such that the world is millions of years old, and that the earth moves around the sun? He says as follows. The crux of the matter is that the time of the appearance and the effects of every idea and thought is predetermined. Nothing is haphazard. For example, we can understand that if the fact of the globe's movement was made known to the masses a few thousand years ago, man would have feared to stand on his feet lest he fall from the force of the Earth's movement. All the more so would he have feared building tall buildings. A general faint-heartedness and incalculably thwarted development would have resulted. The notion of a gravitational force would not have assured him, having seen with his own eyes that anything standing in a moving object cannot be secured from falling. Only after mankind matured through experience was it proper to allow men to recognize the Earth's movement so that from it only good would come to man. He says the same with regard to the age of the universe, that had the Torah spoken about world being billions of years old, mankind would have seen himself as an insignificant blip on the radar of history. What difference does it make what we do with our lives? A blip in time. So the Torah had to describe the world as being created in just a few days to give over the idea that man is the goal of the universe. And then once we have that in mind, we see ourselves as being important, and we realize that, yes, maybe it does make a difference what we do with our lives. This is a whole new interpretation of the idea of Dibra Torah Galashim Bnei Adam. You know, this phrase, the Torah speaks in the language of man. So in the Gemara, it's used in a very, very narrow sense, just to refer to making certain fashas, certain exegeses from certain stylistic phrases in the Torah. There was times that Rishonim was expanded to use the idea that we haven't got words to describe God, really, so we just use words that we can use, which is, you know, he has a hand, he gets angry, and so on. And of course, expanding it to include the idea of the Torah speaks within the intellectual framework of man. Right? The Torah catered towards the intellectual framework of the generation that received it. Which isn't really so much of Cook's Chiddush, he just speaks out a little bit more. It's really kind of implicit in many of the Rishonim too. You have the Rishonim, some of the Rishonim say that the reason why the Torah speaks about God is in very vivid corporeal terms is that that's what the generation of the wilderness really needed to hear to be motivated. It's not just radicals like Rambam who says that, even Chovas HaLevavot says that. They had to be motivated, and that was the only way they could really relate to God. And then in terms of why doesn't the Torah mention the world to come? The afterlife, why doesn't it mention that? So according to Chovas HaLevavot, it's because the Jewish people weren't yet sophisticated enough for those kinds of concepts. Now, I know that sounds very harsh, it sounds impossible if you've grown up with the idea of the Dor HaMidbar, the generation of the wilderness, being these spiritual giants of inconceivable greatness, which is how I grew up thinking about them. But, yeah, okay, you have that view, Jewish tradition, but you also have this other view, that no, they were slaves coming out of Egypt, they didn't have a very good Jewish education, and although they were privy to certain spectacular events, but there's certain things they weren't yet philosophically attuned to. They weren't up to the idea of an afterlife, so the Torah didn't speak about it. And so tying in very closely with this is that the cosmology presented in Tanakh is the ancient cosmology, that the earth is the material realm, and up there is the celestial realm. And that's what people were able to deal with at the time. That's how the Torah presents it. So, you know, this is radically different from the approaches we've seen so far. Right? We've seen those many, many traditionalists who rejected Copernicus because it conflicts with Torah. And we've seen the Maskilim, who accepted Copernicus, claiming that Copernicus is really in the Torah and in Chazal. Which isn't true. Rav Kook is the first one who's bold enough to say it straight, which is that, yes, the traditionalists are correct that Copernicus does go against traditional views and goes against Tanakh. Nevertheless, Copernicus is correct, or can be correct, or is correct. But the point is that we shouldn't be looking at the Torah as a science book, because the Torah is not a book of science. The Torah is a book of theology, and it expresses things in terms of B'lashon B'nai Adam. Which B'nai Adam? The B'nai Adam who received it. And in fact, I think this is a very powerful approach that is very useful for resolving all kinds of conflicts between Torah and science. We're not trying to make the Torah compatible with science here. Okay, so while everyone's digesting all that, let's just go back over these comments here in the textbook, in the chat box here. Say Hashem's in space, does that mean he's physical? Certainly, according to Rambam, it does. Anytime you say that Hashem is spatially located, that means corporeal. But it's no worse than talking about Hashem's hand, right? Hashem's hand, Hashem's arm, Hashem's feet, all these things that Tanakh speaks about. So, you know, what do you make of all that? Do you just say it's allegorical? Or do you say that that is how it's presented at the time because that is the way people grasp it at the time? And we move on from there. Now, I'm perfectly aware that this opens a gigantic Pandora's box. Of course it does. But this is definitely something that has its roots already in the Rishonim, this idea that the Torah phrases things in a way that the Doram was best suited for the Dor HaMidbar. And I think it's the only real approach that's going to work for resolving the issues with Copernicus. Because it's true, in Tanakh, you see the idea that heavens is where God is, or it's heavens as a spiritual realm, and it's up there. Okay, so let's look at these other questions. Okay, it says, how could they be able to handle speaking with God and not with the idea of the afterlife? Well, we can't know. We can't know what it's like being the generation of the wilderness. Reuven says, is it written in a form that's true so that later generations can interpret the same verses according to new knowledge? I wouldn't say that, because when you come coming on to Bereshis, you're saying, well, then we'd be able to make Bereshis fit in with the Torah. And you can't. Maybe we'll have some classes on that, but you can't. What you can do is realize the meaning that it had for the B'nai Yisrael. Drash about the use of the word Anochi. Not familiar with that one, being an Egyptian word. I don't know about that. The mayor saying, but this means Torah is not all truth. It means it's different Torah, Colossians, B'nai Adam. Right, the Torah has to present certain things in terms of the intellectual framework of the generation that received it. And look, this is Chovis Halvavus' explanation of why the Torah does not speaks about reward and punishment in the here and now and not in the afterlife. And that is how some of the Shodim explain the idea of the Torah using corporealism. Rambam has the idea of necessary truths. Right, Rambam says that there are absolute truths and there are necessary truths. Right, a necessary truth is something that's not exactly true, but it's something that's necessary to bring people up to the right level. Rambam has this very important idea, insight, I should say, that that people are different. You can't have chanech l'nar al pi darko. You can't educate everyone in the same way. Some people are more sophisticated, some people are less sophisticated. So often you have to educate it at multiple levels. In a way that may be misleading, not exactly true, but it will gradually lead people towards the truth. Right, Rambam says that, you know, for example, you know, you'll educate kids in a certain way, which isn't exactly true, but it will ultimately lead them to the truth. And Rambam himself did that in his writings. He wrote some misleading things that he felt were necessary truths. And Rambam felt that's what happened to the Torah does also. And Meir says, that lets you deny almost any story in the Torah for asking as being a necessary truth. Yeah, it's a powerful tool, and it does open the door to that. I agree. It's the idea that slippery slope, 100%, a slippery slope. And you know, a lot of powerful ideas are a slippery slope, but that's just the way it is. Life is complicated. I know, we like life to be easy, but life is not easy. If anyone has a better approach to solving the whole Copernican issue here, I'd like to see it. But I think if you look at Tanakh, there's this idea that Shemayim is a celestial realm. Right, up there, celestial realm. Shemaim, Shemaim, Lashem, Asa, Sanal, Ivnei Adam. And the way to, I think the best way to resolve, and it's something that we're going to be, see, helps with so many things. And it's a kind of problem, this doesn't just come up here, it comes up all over the place. Right, in Tanakh, it speaks about the heart and the kidneys as having cognitive functions. Right, you have to es Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha, with your heart, you're loving with your heart. Kilayis, right, the kidneys. What do you say about Kilayis? Haven't got it to hand, if anyone can, that they can punch it up there. Right, the kidneys are making decisions. And for this reason, there were some early Achronim who said that, you know, when these scientists are claiming that the kidneys have no cognitive function, it is heresy because the Tanakh and Chazal say otherwise. Right, so there's all kinds of things like this. And the solution is to say, Divrei Torah Kolasim B'nei Adam, meaning not just the way human people speak, but the intellectual framework of the people that received it. Fly at your outside. Yeah, that's it. I'm saying what? A stomach has cognitive ability? It's not what I saw. Okay. Sends certain signals to the brain. Sure it does, you know, I'm hungry. Things like that. But it doesn't make the decisions. Kidneys aren't making decisions. You know, you can have a heart transplant. It's pretty clear in Tanakh that it's saying that these organs have cognitive functions. And which is not where we stand today. Why? Divrei Torah Kolasim B'nei Adam. Speaks about whatever other things. There's various other things, conflicts between Tanakh and science, which are all the best way of solving them is with this principle. I know it's a hard one to accept, but this is what comes out of Shonen, and this is what the cook says. I think it's the best one. Riven Chesky says, "What other cultures have these beliefs about heart and kidneys?" And I'm sure it's pretty much standard in standard in the ancient world. Okay, this is how. Oh, think about it. You're God giving the Torah, right? You have to work with the people you've got, right? You have to. I mean, look, Rambam takes this even further. Rambam even takes this level of mitzvos, and he says that the whole idea of karbanos is based on working with what the people at that level at the time were used to and were attuned towards. And I know. Scholars, lots of people say Rambam didn't really mean that, and they try and reinterpret Rambam to make him be saying something completely not controversial. But Rambam himself was pretty sure he was saying something very controversial. He says, "I'm going to give an explanation of Karbanos, and no one's going to like it, and you're going to object to it, but I think it's true." And what does he say? That it was because of what the people at the time were used to certain ways of divine service, and then God had to take that into account. Right? So, okay, so here in the comments here, some people are still insisting that maybe hearts and kidneys do have cognitive functions. Okay, I don't think so. I think if you're going to rely on that, it's going to be, if you're going to pin your MNO on that, I think that's going to be complicated. It's going to be difficult. I'm not a doctor, but I think it's going to be difficult to pin your MNO on the heart having, and the kidneys giving an advisory function and the heart being what you love things with. So I think the idea that you see very strongly from many Rishonim and of Cook, I think it's an idea that makes a lot of sense and it's very effective for solving a lot of problems. That the Torah is written according to the intellectual framework of the generation that received it. Now, okay, I think we'll come back to this more at the end, but I really want to finish up this topic in this class so we can move on to something else next week. I just want to mention a few other sources. So you have, I want to mention Lubavitcher Rebbe. Okay, are there any Chabadniks listening to this class? If there are, type yes in the box. Any Chabadniks? Okay. No one's typing yes. Okay. Because if you are, you're not going to like this. Okay, there's a lot of legends about Lubavitcher Rebbe having multiple doctorates in science and math and engineering and the University of Berlin and the Sorbonne. None of this is actually true. He spent a semester and a half at University of Berlin. He studied electrical engineering at a technical school in France. Didn't have any doctorates or anything like that. His approach to science, he was pretty rejectionist about everything. You know, the universe is a few thousand years old. Dinosaur fossils were planted in the ground. Everything Chazal said about science is true. So on. Now, the result, and he doesn't just hold that everything Chazal said about Sanhedrin was true, but he also extends that to the Rishonim, specifically Rambam. But everything Rambam said about science is true. Now, as you'll remember, one of the things Rambam said is that the Earth is the center of the universe. There's in Mishnah Torah. So Lubavitcher Rebbe insists that the Earth is indeed at the center of the universe. So what do you do with Copernicus? So, you know, he first starts saying that the Copernicus of the science itself is flimsy, there's nothing really to support it, it's just a theory, and so on. And then he starts invoking Einstein's theory of relativity. Everything's relative. So it's just as valid to say that the Earth goes around the Sun and the Sun goes around the Earth. It's all the same because of relativity. Now, I'm not a great expert in relativity. However, from discussions I've had, such as with my father's a friend, Lavaha, who was an outstanding physicist, and with others, my own research, I've seen that this is basically a misunderstanding of relativity. For quite a few reasons, but I'll just give the simplest reason, in that relativity does not mean that you can say that the Earth is the absolute center of the universe. Relativity just means that you can't say that anything is absolute. Right? And what Lubavitcher Rebbe is trying to insist here is that the Earth is the absolute stationary center of the universe. That's definitely not what relativity says. There's other reasons too why it's scientifically wrong, but we'll just leave it at that for now. Okay. Now, there's two booklets that came out this century. In the last 100 years, or I should say, against heliocentrism. One of them I have on my website. It's called what's it called again? Mavo HaShemesh. Right. Written by Pinchas David Weberman. And I don't know if he's still alive. If he passed away, it would have been fairly the last few decades. And he starts off with the whole idea that there's a difference between Shemayim and the Aretz, and we're not in the Shemayim. And he goes with a long list of Pesukim, Amari Chazal, saying that the Earth is the center of the universe. And he says, you know, how can it be that everyone's ignoring it? And therefore, you know, is saying, you know, how is it going to be that everyone's adopting Copernicus? It's Kefira. How can we be going against Pesukim, Amari Chazal, the Rishonim, the Achronim who opposed Copernicus? How can we be rejecting that all in favor of science? And another booklet came out just recently, just this last year, by Rav Yosef Zalman Bloch, who's a Rosh Hashiva in Yeshiva Eitz Chaim in Muncie, called Kuntros HaShemesh B'Gvorasei. And again, he denounces Copernicus as being heresy. One of his reasons is Rambam. Rambam's saying that the universe is geocentric, and he says, how can you argue on Rambam? And he also gives some kind of scientific objections, quasi-scientific objections to it. What's interesting is that he deals with the question that if you say the Earth is the absolute center of the universe and everything's going around the Earth, that means that, you know, most of the universe is traveling much faster than the speed of light, because it has to get all the way around the Earth in 24 hours, and it's scientifically impossible for anything to travel faster than the speed of light. But he says, okay, of course it's scientifically impossible, but Hashem could do anything. Right? Hashem is all-powerful. Now, it's interesting that he's doing this in order to save Rambam, because, you know, as you may know, Rambam was dead against positing supernatural miracles. Okay, he doesn't want to. Every man is saying he can keep the rotation of the Earth. Yeah, but he doesn't want to keep the rotation of the Earth. He wants to keep the Earth being absolutely stationary. So he's positing all kinds of, you know, perpetual miracles in order to maintain Rambam's view of the universe, which is really ironic, because Rambam would have been the first to say that he's completely wrong about science. He could be wrong in science. I mean, Rambam held Chazal could be wrong in science. Kal vachomer, Rambam would have agreed that he himself could be wrong in science. And certainly Rambam was against the idea of non-stop miracles. But like I say, you know, this basic charge that they're making that heliocentrism is non-traditional is correct. It is non-traditional. So let's sum up what we have here. I think heliocentrism is a fascinating topic in several ways. Firstly, there's this prevalent myth that it's only the Church who was against Copernicus, and we were always very cool with it. As we've seen, that's not true. There were a few people in the Jewish world who were okay with Copernicus, but the overwhelming majority were dead against it. Right? And major figures we're talking about, right? Maharal, Yonason Eibeschitz, the Yaakov Enden, Sadaka Cohen, Malbim, right? Hassam Sofer, all these big name figures were denouncing Copernicus. And And it does go against Sukkim, and it certainly goes against Chazal. And what's happened now, okay, apart from a few offbeat figures, it's pretty much widely accepted. So this is incredible. Right? A traditional view has been overturned by science. So first, you know, if that's happened in one area, it can happen in other areas. Right? In the same way that we reinterpret things based on science here, it gives us license to do it in other areas. But the mechanism of what's going on is very important. Because, you know, what's happened is that, you know, the Maskilim, who said that really, you know, the tradition has just been lost, but really Chazal and Tanakh, really they knew that the universe is heliocentric, the Maskilim were wrong. They were trying to probably get that to get some more credibility for themselves, right? As we mentioned, the Maskilim didn't like to present themselves as being revolutionary. They wanted to anchor themselves in tradition to give themselves more credibility. But it's just not true. I mean, Chazal certainly did not believe in heliocentrism. And as I've argued, even in Tanakh, Tanakh does not present a heliocentric worldview. Tanakh presents a distinction between Shemayim and Eretz. But science has advanced, and the heliocentrism, the new model of the universe, is pretty much undeniable. We accept it. And the fact that we have a different view traditionally, okay, it doesn't matter, because it was speaking according to the intellectual framework that people used to have. We've advanced through then. Like I say, I recognize that obviously a lot of people are going to have a hard time with this. But I really think that, you know, if you're living in the modern world, and anyone here who's using internet and Adobe Connect Pro is living in the modern world, you're going to be exposed to all kinds of ideas and challenges, intellectual challenges to Torah. And I think it's only going to be a Rambam of Cook kind of approach that's going to work. Because everything else, people get twisted into intellectual pretzels trying to make everything fit in. You have to recognize that there is an evolution. You know, if Cook was actually big into evolution, biological evolution too, because his reasons, well, it wasn't so much scientific reasons, he says that that is the path of history, you know, even theologically speaking, an evolution of mankind. And this is how to explain this topic here. Let's see some of the comments here. Ben Meir disagrees. Okay. Ben Meir wants to use relativity to put Earth at the center, Earth at the center of the universe. Okay. Most physicists I've seen strongly disagree that that's possible. What else are the comments here? Can't read the Hebrew here in the conditional focus. It's too small on my screen. Okay, Ramir is saying he doesn't believe in geocentrism, he's saying it's not wacky, but you still think it's wrong. Okay. While I'm thinking of other questions, I just want to throw out, in terms of what we're going to be topics to move on to now, so basically we have a choice. We could either start on, now that we've finished with these astronomy topics, so we could either start on Bereshit topics, nature of the universe, evolution, the old favorites, or we could do something more, which I think is more interesting than usual, which is discussing Chazal issues, Chazal and science. Perhaps moving on to general topics of rationalism. So in the comments in the chat box here, perhaps you could type in whether you'd rather see Bereshit issues or Chazal rationalism issues. Bereshit issues, we'll be looking at the 6 days, different approaches of how that's fitted in with science, and discussing evolution also, or Chazal and science would be different topics. Okay. The votes here, we have 3 votes for Chazal, 1 vote for Bereshit. Anyone else going to cast a vote? The Bereshit will basically be a rehash of my book, Challenge of Creation, correct? It's not going to be much more than that. Alright, so it looks like the Chazal votes are winning out here. There's one Bereshit. There's a book I can recommend. It's called Challenge of Creation, Judaism's Encounter with Science, Cosmology, and Evolution, available at your local Jewish bookstore. Got it already? Here's not fine. You can read it. If you want to get an idea, then, of the topics that we're going to be doing next week and so on, pull up, the URL of where I have these topics listed. Yeah, it's Yeah, and there we go. Scroll down to the bottom. The science and rationalism. You see, we're discussing topics from 35 through 38, 41. Right, we're discussing topics like giants, dwarves, spontaneous generation, jumping elephant, general rationalism versus mysticism. Speak a bit about the ban in my books. Kind of add in another topic, which I just finished studying, which is extinction. Extinction is a very interesting topic. It's a thing that unites Thomas Jefferson with Malbim and the Sefer Achinuch. Okay, any questions on the astronomy topic? Ben Meir wants what I think about Leo Levy's book about Chazal and science, the white one. Wait, are you talking about Leo Levy's book, or are you talking about Yehuda Levy's book? Yehuda Lander's book. Very different books. White book is by Yehuda Lander, not Leo Levy. Yehuda Levy, you mean, wait, this conversation is being recorded. Okay, I'm not going to give my opinion on it. You can call me or email me. Some of the stuff in it is good, some of the stuff I disagree with. He also writes at the beginning of it that he has a very polemical aim, that he knows there's different views on these things, and he's going to pick the approaches that show Chazal in a good light. Okay, if you're going to do that, then obviously you're going to end up with the approaches by which Chazal are correct. Okay, any other questions? Let's scroll up here, see if there are any questions here that I missed. Reaction to discovery of new planets. Well, I think not. I don't really know much of one. Again, the shocker was the idea that the planets and the stars are just balls of flaming gas or lumps of rock, as opposed to being intelligent beings, which is what the ancients had thought. So you still had some people like Venus and Abishis insisting that the planets and stars are intelligent sentient beings, but the rest of the world pretty much adapted to the new understanding. Didn't make a fuss about that one. But you see, with this whole topic of astronomy, I mean, you see that in ancient times, astronomy wasn't considered to be something like just another field of science, like biology, chemistry, whatever. Astronomy was a quasi-spiritual science, right? And it's out there, was thought to be a celestial realm. Now we just see astronomy as just another branch of science. That's it. But, you know, it is. There's a revolution. The new astronomy. It's really, you know, we've shaken the heavens. We've demoted the heavens. We've said that we've now say that there's a spiritual realm and a physical realm, and the physical realm includes all the visible universe. That's what is really the chiddush of Copernicus. People think that the chiddush of Copernicus is, you know, it goes around the sun, not the sun goes around the earth. That's the least of it. The real focus here, the real revolutionary idea, the idea of putting the earth in the heavens, or rather turning the heavens into outer space. Oh, I never got back to Rav Hirsch. Fine, you're right. So let's get back to Rav Hirsch and see what is Rav Hirsch actually saying. Remember at the time, at the beginning of the class here, when I quoted Rav Hirsch, so Rav Hirsch was saying that Freud speaks in the language of man, like using phrases like sunrise, sunset, just as we do. But I'm not so sure, because that's what it sounds like at the end. But at the beginning, he sounds more like Rav Kook. In other words, he's saying that the purpose of Tanakh is on the ethical and social structure and development of life, servants of laws, which momentous events are converted into concrete convictions. Right, so that sounds, you know, although at the end he sounds more like he's just speaking about sunrise, the language, but at the beginning here he sounds more like of Cook. It's the idea of the intellectual framework. That when the Torah speaks about the universe, it presents it in terms of the intellectual framework that people have, because the real goal of the Torah isn't any of that. The real goal of the Torah is the mitzvos, right, the Jewish way of life. Everything else is just the way to get across that message. Look what he says then. He says, Jewish scholarship regards the Bible as speaking in human language, doesn't describe things in terms of objective truths known only to God, but in terms of human understanding. Right? So I think that first part of the paragraph, he sounds more like Rav Kook. That yes, the intellectual framework in the Torah is a primitive one, it's an ancient one rather, which Shemaim is the celestial realms, and that's up there. But the point is, that's not what the Torah is all about. What the Torah is about is mitzvos. Right? improving us as Jews, and everything else is just the way that the framework within that message is presented. Stanley wants to know: is there anybody of note in today's world who believe in the Haredim who believes in geocentrism? So most people believe in geocentrism, but a lot of people think that it's scientifically fine because a lot of people have heard of this idea of relativity, and people think that that means that geocentrism is perfectly scientifically valid. It's a misconception, but it's a common one. If you were to convince people that geocentrism is not scientifically valid, what would they say? They'd probably say that, you know, the Torah never really meant to describe anything else. Anything other than heliocentrism, I mean. Right, Psaki is pointing out it's correct that the sun isn't the center of the universe either, right? In other words, Copernicus didn't get it exactly right. Copernicus thought that the sun is the center of the universe, and it's not. It's not the center of the universe. Right, but the point is, you know, he didn't conceive of things beyond the solar system, but the point is that Copernicus's model was certainly a lot closer than the Ptolemaic model. Right? The point is that it's the Earth goes around the sun. The sun is the center of gravity of the solar system. Right, it's true. Right, the center of the Earth does not exactly rotate around the center of the sun. Right, it's something. It's the shared center of gravity, which is probably very slightly out of the center of the sun, but not by much. You know, effectively speaking, it's the Earth going around the sun. Okay, even there, you're nitpicking. Okay, any other questions here? I know, it's scientific truth, I know, but the point is that it's not relevant. The point is that the Copernican model is a lot closer than the Ptolemaic model. Right? The Ptolemaic model is that everything goes around the Earth. The Copernican idea is that the Sun is really the basic center of the solar system, and it is. It might not be the exact center, we might not be getting around the exact center of the Sun, but basically the Sun is the thing of largest mass in the solar system, and that's the basic center. And by the way, it brings up a very important point about science. You know, you hear people say that a lot of these Achorim are quoting who were saying that you can't trust science, were saying that scientists change their mind all the time. That's something you'll hear a lot of today. How can you trust science? Scientists change their mind all the time. Now, it's not exactly true. I mean, there's a few responses to that. One is to differentiate between things in science that are like really basic and things that are more like, you know, radical, theoretical. In other words, somebody who has a strong sense for science will understand the difference between the things that are more well-founded and fundamental and the things that are more theoretical. Right? Like, you know, some of the cutting-edge theories in physics are much more theoretical, where, say, the idea that everything's made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons is much more well-founded. But it's more than that. It's that a few other points. One other point is that often when we talk about science changing, what was rejected was not science, it was just the ancient worldview. For example, the idea that the universe has always existed, which was placed by the Big Bang. So the old view, the universe always existed, that wasn't a scientific worldview of science that people had the idea. It was because of Greek philosophy. It wasn't a scientific view that was proven wrong. Another point to remember is that often when science changes, it's not so much changing as being refined. For example, people used to think the Earth was flat, okay? Then they had scientific proofs that the Earth was a sphere. And then they found out, well, no, it's not a sphere. It's actually flattened a bit. It's squashed a bit. And then they worked out that, it's actually squashed a little bit more at the bottom than it is at the top, right? More like kind of pear-shaped. So you can say, well, look, science is changing all the time. No, it's not changing. It's gradually becoming more and more refined. Okay, determinism versus quantum. Yeah. So there have been some radical new things, but when we're talking about basic things like this, like does the entire universe rotate around the Earth, or is the Earth part of the solar system? That's pretty well founded. Okay. Any more questions? By the way, now that we've had all these this whole series of astronomy classes, so I do plan on putting out a book with all these topics we've been discussing. Right, Chazal's view, the ancient Babylonian view. Oh, one other interesting thing about to comment about Copernicus. So I've seen that there have been basically two huge shifts in astronomy over the millennia. There was the shift from the ancient Babylonian model to the Ptolemaic model, right, which was the shift in the idea of the Earth as being flat and everything else being a dome above the Earth. to the Ptolemaic model, which is that the Earth is at the center and everything else is spheres around the Earth. The second shift was from the Ptolemaic model to the Copernican model. Now, the shift from the first to the second, right, from the ancient Babylonian cosmology to the Ptolemaic cosmology, that was pretty straightforward, at least as we see in the Gemara. The Chacham Yisrael said their view, Chacham Yisrael said their view. Rabbeinu HaKadosh said, looks like the Chacham Yisrael are correct. He went and adopted their view, and all of us showing him, learned that Kapshuto. Right, they were fine with it. Okay, the old view is wrong, we'll adopt the new view. It went very smoothly. Compare that to how difficult it was to move over to Copernicus. Much more difficult. And likewise, even though the Rishonim were okay with the idea that the Chachmei Yisrael are wrong and it's time to adopt the Ptolemaic model, but as we saw a few weeks ago, that it's recent, you know, Achronim and so on, looking back on that, had a very hard time with that. And they had to try and reinterpret it to make them speaking up mystical things and so on. See that, up until a couple hundred years ago, people were fine with the idea of altering their worldview. And it's recently that this has become much more difficult for people. I think it's because religion has become, people have become much more conservative, and perhaps religion is more reactionary against the modern world. So people are scared of making a huge jump. And also because the older religion is, the more things become more entrenched, more sacred. And it's harder and harder to change things. Right, that's the point. Right, the Yudha Nasi was a freethinker and adaptive, he wasn't dogmatic. And the Rishonim also were pretty cool with that. It was only after that that things started to change a lot. Okay, so Psachia says, in 100 years, when my great-grandchildren find these videos, they're going to think I'm foolish, because their understanding of the universe will be far advanced. I don't think so. I'll tell you why. I'm sure some things that we believe in will be found to be wrong, but I see science as refining it. But just like the idea that first, you know, they thought the universe, you know, they moved from the flat Earth to the Earth being a sphere, and they found out it's not a sphere, it's squashed, and it's found out it's a bit more squashed on one side than the other side. But, you know, things are going to be refined. I don't think that 100 years from now, they're going to find out that, in fact, the Earth is flat and the center of the universe. Just like Psaki says, just like some of these Rishonim seem foolish when we read them, but they're not foolish at all. No, they don't seem foolish when we read them. This is the thing I always try to get across. A lot of people have this idea that if you have Chazal, the Rishonim, saying something very wrong about science, it means they're foolish. They're not. They're not foolish at all. They're just working with different information. You know, we have the benefit of hundreds of years of collected astronomical information. I guarantee you, look into some of the astronomical calculations that the ancients did without the benefit of calculators and computers or anything like that. It's very hard to follow them. They weren't foolish at all. They were just as smart as us. The thing is, you know, operating within a different set of assumptions without the benefit of the cumulative knowledge that we have today. It's a big mistake that people make to see something wrong as being foolish. And I think that's why it's very important to learn history and to get a sense of historical perspective. Because this is actually a big issue people have. That, you know, that if Rashi believes in mermaids and there's no such thing as mermaids, it means Rashi is foolish. It doesn't mean that. You have to understand, you know, a little bit about the mindset of people and what information they have to work with and so on. Yeah, I like Mordechai's point here in the chat box. Someone who's open to proof from the natural world will be less ridiculed than a fundamentalist approach which deifies accepted nonsense against the observed truth. Okay, I think we've reached the end of it. End of tonight's class. See you all next week.